From the studios of WEKU on the campus of Eastern Kentucky University, it's time for Eastern Standard. I'm John Hingsbergen. Our show is normally live and interactive on these Thursday mornings, but this week we have another recorded show featuring some previously unheard interviews. We'll get to Marco Werman, the host of The World, and NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik and his book about the media empire of Rupert Murdoch. But first, David Bell. David is a professor at Western Kentucky University and last fall published his fifth mystery novel. David spoke with me from the studios of Western Kentucky University Public Radio in Bowling Green.
Never Come Back tells the story of a woman named Elizabeth Hampton. She's 26 years old. She's a graduate student. And I'm not giving anything away to say that on the very first page of the book, Elizabeth's mother turns up dead. And so the first question is, what happened to her mother? Did she die of natural causes, or did she meet foul play? As Elizabeth looks into this more, and as she finds out more about her mother, Elizabeth finds out that her mother had an entire life that Elizabeth did not know about, that there are secrets in her mother's past, that there are dark things in her mother's past, and that Elizabeth never knew about these things. And as she finds out about them, she starts to get closer to the answers about what really happened to her mother. Did she die of natural causes, or was she murdered? So it's really about family secrets coming out. It's also about, I think we all grow up thinking that our parents didn't have lives before we were born. We think the day we were born is when our parents started existing. But it's about Elizabeth realizing that her mother had this entire life, this complex life, before Elizabeth was even born. And she's just coming to grips with all of that.
Where does a story like this come from as the writer? Is it from personal experience at some level, from other influences in your life?
More than anything, I mean, the plot line itself, you know, the things that happen in the book are made up. I don't have these crazy things happening in my life. But the things that the characters are dealing with, the emotions, the thoughts, the growth that the characters go through, those things come from my life or from the lives of people who I observe. So, I mean, we all think about our families. We all think about how complex our family relationships are. Families are a place where we feel very safe, usually, and we feel the most at home and the most comfortable. But families can also be sources of a lot of misunderstanding and a lot of frustration and a lot of anger. And so I think that being in a family is a universal experience. We're all in families of some kind. And so it's natural to write about families and how complicated it can be to be in a family.
As a novelist, what are the challenges you face in forming characters, creating dialogue among them, creating relationships among them?
I think people read almost any book for the characters. I think sometimes there's a misconception that if you're writing a thriller or a mystery novel, that it's more about plot than it is about character, and that other books, like a really literary novel, might be more about character than it is about plot. But I think that any book worth reading has to have good characters, has to start with characters. So I think the challenge for any writer is to create characters who the reader understands. They should not be perfect characters. I don't write about perfect people. I don't write about saints or superheroes or people without flaws. I think people want to read about characters with flaws, because we all have flaws and we're used to dealing with people with flaws. So I think that's the challenge, is to write about characters who are recognizable and easy for the reader to understand, who the reader can empathize with. And sometimes those characters may do things that challenge the reader, that make it difficult for the reader to decide if they really like that character or not. And I think that's okay. I think it's okay for a writer to make it difficult for the reader to decide how much they really like a character or how much they empathize with the character. I think in the end, if the reader understands something about the character, then the reader's going to go where that character goes.
I assume the process varies from author to author, but which comes first for you, the story or the characters?
Yeah, usually I think it starts with the characters. I think it starts with a situation. What if your mother died and you found out that she had a secret past, right? My book, Cemetery Girl. What if you had a child who disappeared and that child was gone for 4 years and then came back and refused to tell you where she was? So, I mean, usually it starts with a situation. Usually it's a what-if game. It's just the oldest act of imagination that I think we all do, going back to when we're kids, is saying, what if? You know, what if this happened? What if we did this? What if that happened? So it usually starts with that. And then it's a matter of seeing where those characters want to go. You know, where if I imagine this character, what kind of trouble are they going to get into? Because that's what people read for. They want to see those characters digging themselves into a hole, and then can they dig their way out before the end of the book?
What about sense of place? Will readers of Never Come Back recognize Kentucky or southwestern Ohio in the story, or Bloomington, Indiana, for that matter?
My books are all set in made-up places, and they're set in towns in Ohio. But I think that if you know a place like Bowling Green, like Cemetery Girl has a lot about a place that looks very much like Kiriakis Park and Fairview Cemetery. So usually I'm writing about mid-sized towns, kind of like Bowling Green. So in Never Come Back, she's a graduate student, so there's a university there. So, I mean, I think I am writing about places that are familiar to me. I also like writing about those mid-sized towns because we tend to think of crime and wild things happening in big cities. But I think anyone who's lived in a mid-sized town or a small town or a college town, they know that as many strange things happen in those towns as can happen in a big city, and that strange things happen in Ohio or Kentucky or Indiana as happen in New York City or Los Angeles. So I like kind of writing about those a little out of the way places and, you know, peeling back the lid on what's going on in those places.
You're involved in this year's Kentucky Book Fair. What is that about for you? Is it merely about getting out there and marketing your work, or is there something else?
Well, one of these book fairs like this, and the Kentucky Book Fair does a great job of this, is that you really get to talk to readers a lot. If I'm sitting there at my table and readers are coming by, and sometimes they're buying the book, sometimes they're just coming by to talk. But it's a great opportunity to talk to readers to find out what other books they like to read, what they're looking for in a book, if they've read a previous book of mine, what they think about it. So it's a golden opportunity to get to talk to real readers these people who come to these events are passionate about books. You'll see people carrying around a stack of books as tall as they are, right? So, I mean, these are people who love to read. They love books. It's also an opportunity to get to know other authors. I mean, you go to one of these events and you sit at a table next to an author who I might not ordinarily get to know or might not ordinarily cross paths with. But it's a great opportunity to see these other writers and to see this huge variety of books that are being published, not just by Kentucky authors, but by authors from all over the country. So it's a reader's paradise, and it's a writer's paradise to go to one of these events.
Let's talk about the future of books as we have known them. You and I grew up in a world in which books were hardbound or softbound objects we could hold in our hand, and those seem to be diminishing, if not being totally replaced by electronic devices. What's the future of literature in a potentially bookless world?
Well, I suspect that books, real books, meaning books you hold in your hand, are not ever going to go away. I just don't see that happening. Those books may have to share space or share marketplace with ebooks. I don't think they'll go away entirely. And as a reader, I don't have any desire to read something electronically, Part of it is because, like I said earlier, I love books so much. Also because I spend my entire day at work, as a lot of people do, staring at a computer screen. So I don't want to go and stare at another screen as I'm trying to unwind at night. But as a writer, I mean, for writers, I think there's a huge potential here, because I think that it's going to create avenues for a lot of people to be published. It's going to create opportunities for a lot of smaller and mid-sized publishers to step into the marketplace. It's just another way for readers to find books. And that, you know, the fundamental part of reading and of books, at least if you're writing fiction, is stories. And stories are always going to find an audience. Good stories are always going to find an audience. And if you look back over time, there's always a new format coming in. You know, there are hardback books. There are then paperback books. There are pulp magazines. And then there are glossy magazines. You know, TV was supposed to destroy reading. And, you know, all of these things survive if there are good stories. So I think the future is going to be just fine as long as there are people who want to tell stories and want to read stories. And there are always going to be people who want to do that, because I think that's fundamental to human nature.
As a college professor, talk about your experience in teaching writing to others or mentoring them. Are there young people coming to you seeking your advice on how to pursue a career in writing?
Yeah, we have a lot of students at WKU who are very passionate about reading and writing, and we have a lot of students who are talented. It's somewhat difficult to look at someone who's 20 years old and to predict their future, because you have no idea where that person's going to go. If, you know, if they're going to continue to write once they're out of college, what choices they make in life as they go forward. But I'm always impressed when I go into the classroom and I read the things that my students write. And it's one of the more pleasurable things to do, is to see these students who are excited about stories. They inspire me. You know, I read the things they write and it makes me want to go write. When I'm writing and I'm doing, you know, I'm doing my own writing and I feel like that's going well, it inspires me to go to the students and to share that with them. But I mean, I'm lucky that I have a day job as an English professor that allows me to still be reading and talking about stories all day. Whether I'm writing or I'm teaching, I'm talking about stories and I'm talking about writing, and that's what I like to do.
The book is Never Come Back, the latest mystery novel from Western Kentucky University professor David Bell. It's published by New American Library. Coming up, NPR's media correspondent discusses his research and the resulting book about the media empire of Rupert Murdoch on Eastern Standard. This is Eastern Standard on the WEKU stations. I'm John Hingsbergen, and we turn now to author and NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik and his book about Rupert Murdoch. As David joined me from NPR's studios in New York, I asked him what he means when he calls Murdoch's News Corporation the last of the old media empires.
Well, look, you can look at News Corp and its the other half of the Murdoch empire now, as he split it earlier this year, 21st Century Fox. And the 21st Century in Fox includes, you know, Fox News, and it includes FX, and it includes Fox Searchlight Pictures and Fox Studios, and, you know, the largest private broadcaster in the UK, and the largest, you know, 50% controlling stake in the largest cable operator in Australia, and all these properties that you and I don't really think about in Latin America and India and a little bit in China. And, you know, he's on six continents, and you could say, wow, this guy controls so much. The Wall Street Journal, the New York Post, and a host of other newspapers, especially in the UK and Australia as well. But it's those newspapers that define Murdoch's heart and soul. You know, he grew up as the son of a very accomplished Australian political journalist who became a newspaper executive in his hometown of Melbourne, the second largest city in Australia. And he loves newspapers. But the interesting thing about it is, you know, he loves newspapers for two reasons. He grew up in them. He loves the feel of it tactilely. And if you notice on the cover of the book, it almost looks like it's a bit of a crumpled newspaper page on the picture. And that was done with for a reason. Those newspapers are, you know, their fortunes are declining, even though they were the basis of his original fortune. And yet, you know, they have provided him with they have provided him with political influence, in part because, you know, he wields them as political weapons or political tools anyway to support or oppose candidates he identifies with or against. And those that he identifies against, I might add, he doesn't look as for people that he opposes, but people that he then sort of he looks at as enemies. He really can have his papers go to town against them. But he's willing to switch back and forth between parties, between the Labour Party and the more conservative party, which ironically is called the Liberal Party in Australia, between the Democrats and Republicans in this country. The New York Post, you know, sort of lifted Ed Koch out of obscurity in a crowded Democratic field to become mayor and helped him, you know, to three terms in this city and really to become a nationally prominent figure, helped Rudy Giuliani become mayor and become a national figure, helped George Pataki become governor of New York, a figure who might not have been well known, but prior to that, and also who supported Hillary Clinton, a Democrat, you know, in 2000 and 2006 as she ran for Senate. These were the Democrats and the people in the Labour Party that he supports, like Tony Blair in England, were people of the center left, not the strongest liberals. And he also supports some very conservative folks as well. But because these politicians have the hope that he might swing from one party to the other, they're very attentive to him. If he only supported every time a Conservative Party members in the UK or Republicans in this country, they might listen a lot less closely.
Well, David, as an Australian, how did Murdoch become motivated? What was his interest in getting involved in American media? Was it purely economic, a matter of making money?
I think he saw a global stage on which he could play a larger figure. I think he felt that he had outgrown Australia. You know, he had been at school in Oxford in England at the time of his father's death in the 50s. His father was a much older man, and Murdoch was a young man, ironically quite left of center politically at the time. He saw that there were these connections between where he grew up, what became a Commonwealth nation of Australia and the mother country of the UK. He went there and, leveraged his fortune in Australia to acquire the News of the World and then the Sun tabloids, which became his financial foundation for expanding in the US and then in buying prestigious papers in the UK and much later, the Wall Street Journal. And so each place sort of served as the jumping off point for the next. I think he also felt kind of confined and thwarted in the UK, which sounds kind of ridiculous. I mean, by 1981, he owned four of the major newspapers, national newspapers in Great Britain, including the top-selling daily, the top-selling Sunday paper, and the two most prestigious papers in the country. And he, by the late 80s, he had established, I guess, 1990, he had helped take over the leading private satellite broadcaster. It was not necessarily going to be a financial success from the outset, so he had to borrow a lot of money, and ultimately he sold public shares in what became called B Sky B as a way of financing that. But he found Britain so unreceptive to him, so hostile in his mind, and certainly there were those who scorned him and mocked him and denigrated him, who sneered at him because he was Australian, who said, well, he's just a coarse, money-grubbing guy. We don't want anything to do with him. He's the guy who put bare-breasted girls on page 3 of the Sun tabloid, and we're above that. You know, he now owns our beloved Times of London. How dare he? Well, the Times is a lively, smart, interested, and culturally aware newspaper. It's a different newspaper than it would have been without him, but a very good one. He felt America was more receptive, more like Australia, more interested in self-made men. And in his mind, they really were almost all men. And so he felt a kinship to Americans in that way. Now, America proved to have a lot of regulations, too, but he often ignored or pushed the limits of them. And ultimately, regulators caught up. And although he had to get rid of a property or two here or there in Boston and Chicago and even in New York for a time here, he ultimately reality and regulations exceeded to his wishes rather than the other way around most of the time.
Well, David Folkenflik, have you ever met Murdoch either in research for this book or as in your role as an NPR media reporter?
Well, you know, his people made clear they didn't want me to write the book and they weren't going to participate in any way. And there were times where, you know, an interview with a very senior News Corp executive was canceled shortly before it when one of Murdoch's top aides called to say, don't do this. And similarly, other units I went to at Fox News and other places, they said, look, the big guy says, no, we're not going to do it. Now, that said, I made a lot of effort and I interviewed a ton of executives and journalists throughout all three countries who work for or have worked for Mr. Murdoch's properties. I met Mr. Murdoch once. I believe it was only just the once. I may have shaken his hand a second time at an event where he was announcing the launch of a thing called The Daily, which was going to be an iPad tablet-only publication that he spent, you know, tens of millions of dollars on and ultimately pulled the plug on because it was too costly to support. But I met him when he was launching the Fox Business Network at an incredible gala at the Metropolitan Museum of Art. You have all these stars there. Regis Philbin is there. Mel Brooks is there. Barbara Walters is there. You have guys like me who cover the media, and we were, you know, invited to attend and observe the celebration. You know, a great night for Roger Ailes and for his boss and patron, Rupert Murdoch. And I went up to him and introduced myself and, suggested that, you know, we'd be delighted to have him on our air, talk about Fox Business Network and talk about other you know, his other properties and his priorities. This was in, I believe, late 2007, and he sort of looked at me, and he tends to mumble in person a little bit. He said, well, you know, I don't think you'd be very interested in that. And I said, I think you do yourself a disservice. You underestimate how interesting you are. And he kind of smiled. We made small talk for a few minutes, and, you know, I congratulated him and went on my way. But, you know, I've always thought he was more interesting than he gave himself credit for. He's not a very introspective guy. He doesn't engage in a lot of self-reflection. And so, you know, he may not think that what he's done is all that interesting, even as he demands respect from people that he thinks aren't giving it to him. And, you know, he has this conception of himself that the elites of the world have disrespected him and that he is on the outside looking in and that he and his executives and fellow Australians in particular are these, you know, merry pirates kind of laying siege to the elites. And it certainly is true that establishment figures and, you know, the BBC and the Australian Broadcasting Company and the New York Times all kind of look down on him. But he has made reality bend to his will. You know, prime ministers, aspiring prime ministers and, you know, major political figures in this country, too, have had to show deference to him. One of his senior aides described it to me as kissing the ring, the way in which all Australian political figures, whether they liked him or hated him, would fly up from Australia to meet him here in New York City, just a few blocks from where I'm talking to you now, as opposed to down in Australia at his family estate outside Melbourne, as a way of showing deference and respect to him, you know, kissing the ring, a very signal term. You know, the establishment has not only embraced him, but he's created his own establishment that they have to acknowledge and do business with.
What surprised you most about Murdoch in your research?
You know, he's not nearly as conservative as people make him out to be, even though he's quite conservative. He is at times very sentimental. He's exceptionally loyal to people who are loyal to him. There's this quality among Australians, it's part of the national identity, called mateship, that is unlike anything that we experience here in the U.S., where, you know, a guy is your mate. And I've heard the term. He says, hey, it's my mate. And you figure it's maybe what fraternity brothers feel toward one another. But in reality, this is something where you say, okay, your mate is somebody that you know, if he needs a job, you find one for him. If he gets in a fight, whether he's right or wrong, you fight alongside him. If he needs being pulled on the straight and narrow, maybe you do that too. But as long as he's loyal to him, you're loyal to him regardless of the facts. And it means that, you know, there are times where, you know, his chief gossip columnist for the New York Post, which is a paper Murdoch loves, was caught basically accepting a fair amount of money, goods worth thousands of dollars, from some of the people he wrote about. There was no real punishment. It was just acknowledged in public. There was kind of a rebuke. They moved on. One of his favorite columnists, Steve Dunleavy, was, you know, the editor-in-chief admitted under oath in a lawsuit that's moving forward now that this Australian older columnist had called a fellow colleague, an African-American, the N-word. The only punishment he received was he was told, don't do that again. Now, in many companies, you'd say, look, this has to have consequences. Maybe it's not a firing offense at all, but, you know, certainly you have consequences that are noted. A verbal rebuke might be seen by a lot of people of color and a lot of others as insufficient in terms of a signal to be sent about how seriously it's being taken. And that amid a culture of kind of fraternity-like excess and glee, sharing pictures of celebrities who have texted pictures of their genitals to one another and things like that, you know, in a way that made some women journalists at the paper very uncomfortable, even though we think of the New York Post as being sort of this brawling, freewheeling, spirited publication. You know, it's also a workplace where people have to do business, and not everybody wants to see that stuff.
David, I know your time is short here, but I'm wondering to what extent Murdoch is actually involved in his media operations, such as the New York Post or in Fox News. The slogan that they use on Fox News, fair and balanced, does he subscribe to that approach, and does he really believe that that's what he is providing?
I think he thinks that Fox News is a counterweight to the liberalism that he sees and that Roger Ailes and that his other news executives see in the New York Times, I'm sure on NPR, CBS, NBC, take your pick. I think that the Fox News is clearly to the right of where he is, but it shares his sensibility in the sense that, it can be a bruising place when it goes after people. It doesn't pull its punches. It, knows how to land a blow pretty hard. The New York Post and these tabloid newspapers are really the things that are closest to his heart. You know, when I talk to editors and former editors at those publications, they say, they receive calls from him very frequently. He doesn't dictate what they're going to publish, but, he asks questions about what they've published in recent days. And for papers like the New York Post that lose tens of millions of dollars a year every year, a paper that's never made him any money, executives there said to me, look, we had to put out a newspaper that we knew he would like, because in a rational world, he would have shut it down or sold it and somebody else would have slashed it very deeply in terms of the resources available to it. So, they have that in, as one editor of the London Sun, testified, they have his voice in their head even when they never speak to him. But those are the papers, the Sun of London, the New York Post, that are closest to his spirit, a populist, center-right, culturally conservative kind of approach, a place that feasts on gossip, treats celebrities and politicians as sport, really focuses on crime and scandal, and tries to have a good time doing it. A good time for itself may not be a good time, and what readers may like may not be a good time for the people experiencing that coverage, but that's not their problem.
Well, what's next after these old media empires? Murdoch is at the head of an old media empire, and you're saying he's essentially the last of a kind. What follows Murdoch?
Well, I don't think newspapers are going to vanish, but I don't think they're necessarily always going to play the same degree of importance over time. But if they do, it will be because of a new brand of entrepreneurs. You think of Jeff Bezos, who created Amazon. He bought the Washington Post out of his personal fortune for $250 million, a lot less than he would have had to spend on it a decade ago, and what for him is pocket change. And he thinks that he can bring really new thinking about the relationship between the consumer. Think about customer service and Amazon, how tightly knit they are, between the consumer and the news organization. A guy named Pierre Omidyar, who thought about buying the Post but didn't, he was a co-founder of eBay, another billionaire, and he's willing to spend $100 million to create a brand new digital news organization that has the a strong adversarial investigative journalism of somebody like Glenn Greenwald, who he's hired from The Guardian and who has been responsible for a lot of these exposés about what the NSA has been doing in terms of rampant surveillance of our digital footprint in this country and abroad. A third guy, Chris Hughes, is a very young man, but a billionaire from helping to start up Facebook. And, he's got insights about how social media is used and how people consume and share information. He bought the New Republic, a somewhat liberal weekly publication, political publication based in Washington. And he's trying to figure out a good business plan for that. So if these older publications have new vitality and new vigor, or if these brand new creations are going to help redefine the news landscape, it may be because of a new brand of digital digital moguls who are comfortable in this sphere, who, you know, speak it fluently, and who may have totally different insights about the way in which the consumer experiences news and information.
Well, David Folkenflik, this is fascinating stuff. Thank you so much for spending time with us. David is the author of Murdoch's World, The Last of the Old Media Empires. Thanks for being with us, David.
Hey, my great pleasure. Thanks so much for your interest, John.
This is Eastern Standard on the WEKU stations. In a moment, we'll meet the host of PRI's program featuring an international approach to news, The World. And a reminder, this show will be available online later today and will be able to be downloaded as a podcast. The show will repeat Sunday evening at 6 o'clock. We're interested in hearing from you anytime with your comments or suggestions. WEKU Eastern Standard at gmail.com. This is Eastern Standard on the WEKU stations. In this special holiday week edition of our show, we turn now to the world. Marco Werman has been working in journalism since he was 16, when he began as a copy boy at the News and Observer in Raleigh, North Carolina. A former Peace Corps volunteer, Werman got his start in radio while freelancing in Burkina Faso, West Africa, for the BBC World Service, where he later worked as a producer. Marco has been involved in starting a new public radio station, reported from Rome for the old Monitor Radio, and was part of the team that started The World in 1995.
Tell me about becoming a journalist at 16 years old. Some of us did, but it was the high school newspaper for us.
I did that too. I was also just really interested in speaking with people who weren't from my high school, who were big players. And I would go down to North Carolina State University, and they had this wonderful lecture series, and just to see if I could get interviews with, I don't know, Ralph Nader or Morris Udall or Eldridge Cleaver and William Kunstler and Julian Bond and all these people, Angela Davis, all these people were willing to speak to a then 15-year-old. And I would just wait for them at the side door of the lecture hall, and they were, every one of them was, and they didn't just do it to humor me. They were really interested in my questions from a young high school cub reporter. But the News and Observer for me was a real way to, I mean, obviously I was interested in journalism and becoming a journalist, and that was a way for me to get my feet wet with the pros. And I started at the bottom when they actually still had copy boys, and worked my way up to writing some headlines, and then I went away to college, and that was the end of my time at the News Observer, but it was a great start.
Native of North Carolina?
Native of New York City. We moved to North Carolina when I was 7.
You had the journalism bug early in your life. What brought that on for you? Do you have first recollections of some news event or some circumstances that caused you to have that interest?
My family always had books by photojournalists around the house. The Family of Man was there. I was exposed to the work of Henri Cartier-Bresson when I was really young. And so the presence of all these historical photos combined with a couple of key things. I mean, I had a, it was kind of our, my godfather, Ernest Pendrell, worked for ABC News, and he was a documentary filmmaker and made documentaries about the day in the life of a Vietnam soldier. He went to Vietnam, he covered that, documentary about the Vienna Boys Choir, and I just saw the vast kind of frame that you had to work with. You were just basically telling stories about anybody, anything, anywhere in the world. If there's an early memory, I still believe that I remember the day Kennedy got shot, even though I was about 2.5. I don't remember the actual event, but I do remember my mother standing in back of me. We were about to go take a walk in the snow in New York, and her standing in front of the TV with my snowsuit zipper halfway up, and she couldn't get the zipper halfway up because she was staring at the TV in shock, like so many people. Maybe that kind of eked its way into my body and my brain.
I would think so. I was a little older, but the feeling, the emotion of the event, I would imagine, would leave an impression on someone at the impressionable age psychologically. Huh?
It may have happened. I'm not going to say definitively that's what turned the switch for me, but a number of things turned the switch.
You're a broadcaster, obviously a journalist in the truest sense of the word from your very roots. How do you define journalism?
Wow. I've gone through so many different definitions of journalism since I've been doing it, but I think I've kind of come to a definition where it's really telling stories, journalism on radio anyway, telling stories that will help people understand the world they live in. Telling stories about people so that the people hearing them better understand the world they live in. And with any luck, with any hope, they'll, if they see something wrong with the world they live in, they'll act to change it.
You've spent some time overseas, Africa, Rome, I imagine other locations. Why an interest in going beyond the borders of our own country?
When I was in Peace Corps, I came back from the States a couple of times. And the very first time I came back on a visit, I noticed how hard it was to talk to Americans about other parts of the world. It seemed like their level of interest was curious on first blush. The more you talked about the place you were, I was in Togo with Peace Corps. The first time I came back to the States, there was a woman sitting next to me on the plane, said, "So what's going on in Africa?" I was like, "Well, I'm actually in one of 55 countries. Togo, what can I tell her about Togo? Well, let's see, it's about 300 miles long. It's about 50 miles wide." And I could already see kind of the interest kind of like fading away. So I really wanted to tell people about what I was doing, how the people lived. And I came back to this idea that journalism could be, I don't want to call it kind of a teaching tool, but this really accessible way into what's going on around the world if it's presented the right way. And so it was, it kind of started there. It was my desire to join Peace Corps, partly was driven out of a desire to be somewhere else in the world, to travel. But in doing that, I realized that there are people in this country who are curious and want to get out in the world, and there are people who obviously don't have the means, but also don't have the curiosity. And so travel, getting people interested in the rest of the world, it's all part of the same package for me. If I can travel, then, and somebody else can't, then I want them to kind of feel what that's like.
What is it about Americans that many people do not have an interest in what is going on beyond our borders?
That's a huge question. I think, you know, at the very bottom of it, the fundamental answer is it's about education and getting people to be curious on their own, to be naturally curious. I feel American education has really not been what it really could be, and has really been a disappointment for a lot of people. And I feel like a lot of students and young people in this country have been let down by our educational system. If I had to kind of start somewhere, I'd say it's because kids are not being pushed to be more curious about the world. There is an extraordinary statistic, and I don't know how fresh this is, but a couple of years ago, less than 25% of Americans had a passport. So I understand that some of that may have to do with just basic finances. People aren't going to travel outside this country. It is expensive. It also, it's kind of a chicken and egg thing. It also speaks volumes about our own natural curiosity about the rest of the world. You know, I understand why, how it's evolved that way, but I think we can do better.
You have the distinction of being able to say you were there at the creation in a non-biblical sense of the world. Talk about the world as a radio program and how it came about and its mission and concept.
Yeah, it's always, you know, it's inevitably that answer that I love saying. It's like, well, how long have you been at the world? And then I'll say, well, I actually helped create the world. Yeah,
absolutely.
Delusions of grandeur. It was a very exciting moment. I've been involved in a number of startups in my life. You mentioned that radio station in the Adirondacks, but this was definitely the most exciting. And, you know, when we started up, we had huge ambitions. We had a big budget compared to what we have today. And what was really very cool is that a group of people from all over the world, basically it was BBC people, but from many different language services at the BBC, another half of the room, we're talking 20 people here, were people already working in public radio in the United States. So it was bringing together two sides of the Atlantic to talk about radio and to talk about the idea of having a 60-minute, 5 days-a-week program that basically got Americans interested in the rest of the world. And so that was right up my alley.
Whose idea was that?
It was Public Radio International's idea. they had basically up to that point been a distributor of programs, but not a maker of programs. Now, they couldn't make the program in Minneapolis. They weren't set for that, but they were set to create a co-production with a highly relevant news partner, the BBC, an American production partner that had a lot of experience with national programming. WGBH was chosen. WGBH also had television experience doing co-productions with the BBC, Masterpiece Theater. And so the pieces were in place for a really successful program. And then we basically, in May of 1995, myself and about 15 other people spent a week in Boston, in Rockport, just outside of Boston. And we had all the tools of the BBC. We were able to bring in tape. And we basically spent a week making mock programs. How would this show sound? Why would it be different from anything else on public radio? How do we get interested? How do we get Americans interested in what's going on around the rest of the world without being preachy, without being academic, without hitting them over the head? So those questions remain really relevant today. There are a few things in those early days that survive today. The global hit, the attention to music, and using music as a way to kind of get into other cultures and issues around the world. The GeoQuiz, still there today. So it was that moment of being there at the creation that, you know, the fact that we're still around today makes that moment really exciting.
How has the show evolved?
I think what's happened is in the daily grind of cranking out a hour-long news show in basically a six-hour time window, we have kind of involuntarily built up this muscle, these editorial chops, where almost unconsciously we realize now that listeners are more interested in hearing somebody tell a story, an average person from somewhere else in the world who is more like them, as opposed to a pundit explaining why something is happening in Syria, for example. We just want to hear the voices of Syrians telling us what their lives are like. That's where it really sings. And I think the more we do that, the more it really is a program about the world, and less a program explaining why the world is the way it is today, which we still do. You have to do that with breaking news. You have to do that with countries that people don't know where they are on a map. So you have to do both. But I think we've definitely evolved into a program that's more about telling stories about the human experience around the globe.
What has been perhaps the most notable experience you've had in terms of an interview or a story that you've worked on that has made the most difference or impact on you personally?
I mean, there have been so many moments like that. I guess it was a trip I took to Japan after the earthquake and tsunami in 2011, and going up to Fukushima. And I've never really been exposed to that level of destruction before. And I mean, it's been said many times how resilient the Japanese were with that disaster. There are those moments where you get in the field and there's nobody to really speak to, and you're walking around this devastated city like Ishinomaki in northeastern Japan, one of the worst hit cities of any that were touched by the tsunami. There's nothing you can do but just start talking into the tape recorder and telling people what you see and just how you're affected by it. That remains very, it's watermarked in me, and it's hard to escape that.
What interview or what story would you like to do?
There's so many. What I will tell you is one moment, and this is for any budding journalists out there, if you have a thought about a story that would be cool, don't wait and see if it could be cool or would be interesting. Just do it. When I was living in West Africa, the president of Burkina Faso was killed. The great Nigerian musician lived maybe 500-600 miles away. Fela Kuti wrote a song about this assassinated leader, Thomas Sankara. And I always felt like, having lived in Ouagadougou, I should go meet this musician and have him tell me about why he felt so strongly about writing the song about Thomas Sankara. And Fela died in 1997 and never was able to do the story. But that's one I really wish he were alive and I could do it.
Let's talk about the funding model of public broadcasting and the way we pay for programs like The World in terms of listener donations.
It doesn't really matter how I feel about the funding model in a way. I mean, there's so many different funding models. If we were to invent a public broadcasting system today, would we do it the same way? Would we just insist that taxpayer dollars went to public broadcasting? Or maybe the government would say, let's do it like they do in the UK with a license fee for every radio set in your house. But that's changing. People are listening to radio on computers now. So, you know, government funding has been steadily disappearing. And I think a lot of local stations probably don't even get any government funding anymore. It's all done on listener support. So that alone is reason why listeners need to step in. And quality programming like The World, like everything you guys do with the Eastern Standard, I mean, that's not possible without money. And if the government isn't giving it, well, then the money has to be found somewhere. At the national level, we're able to go around and get and try and entice large grants. That's less possible at the local level because those large grants don't exist. Maybe they're smaller grants. The best grant, though, is a listener calling in and pledging their support for a year or whatever they can do.
Let's talk about, in just a couple of short moments, the future of The World within the future of public radio, public broadcasting in general, the moving into the digital realm and the possibilities that exist that broadcasting as we know it today, well, we know it's not going to look the same at some point
right.
in the future. How is The World preparing for that digital future?
Well, as our executive producer, Andrew Sussman, calls it, we're steadily heading into that post-broadcast future with the idea that we're still going to be broadcasting, but that the radio broadcast is intricately entwined with multimedia and everything online, the digital world. We were very clear when the show started that we were going to have this digital component, and along the way we've had many different iterations of theworld.org. That has just changed again so that we have a new website. It's cleaner and leaner than ever. What we're able to do with the website is provide multiple levels of information that take the stories that we hear on the radio beyond what you hear on the radio. So video. We actually have a video producer on staff right now. We have a social media producer who's connecting everybody, who's sharing what we're doing on the radio. Producers are sharing with listeners. Listeners are sharing with producers. And so that's a whole community that is beyond our broadcast community, or maybe it's part of the broadcast community. We're still trying to sort that out like everybody is. Who's listening? Who's online? Are the groups the same? Are they different? Is there any kind of slice of that Venn diagram that kind of is significant? So we've already staked out that future. Digital is a space that we, like every other broadcaster, is deeply involved in, and it's just going to be more so. I mean, we're on over 300 stations. We feel that we can keep on getting additional carriage throughout the public radio system in the U.S. It's not going to grow much more beyond that. So where we're going to find new listeners and new fans and new people who are curious about The World, small t, small w, is online.
Marco Werman, thank you so much for being with us on Eastern Standard.
John, a real pleasure. Thank you.
Marco Werman is host of The World, heard Monday through Thursday evenings at 7 o'clock on WEKU and over 300 stations, reaching nearly 3 million listeners each week. Thanks to our guests, Marco Werman, David Folkenflik, and David Bell. Eastern Standard is a production of the WEKU stations at Eastern Kentucky University. Our associate producers are Andrew Moorhead and Richard Turner. Our technical director is Jonice Franklin. A reminder, this show will be available online later today and will be able to be downloaded as a podcast. You'll find information and links at weku.fm. The show will also repeat Sunday evening at 6 o'clock. We're interested in hearing from you anytime with your comments or suggestions. wekueasternstandard@gmail.com is the email address. You can also follow us on Twitter at @WEKUEST. For WEKU and Eastern Standard, I'm John Hingsbergen.